session.
Okay, we have the last argument for the afternoon, Wong versus University of Pittsburgh et al., appellate number 25-1816.
May it please the court, Robert Renner on behalf of appellant Norman Wong.
Is it pronounced Wong or Wang?
It is pronounced Wong, is there one O, Wong.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Be granted.
There are many legal issues on this appeal. I would like to address two of those legal issues. The first is state action. The second is defamation.
Okay, we may have some questions about other subjects, just so you know.
That'd be fine.
Okay. Right. State action first. Go ahead.
State action was addressed in the district court's ruling on summary judgment. In its opinion, the district court failed to discuss the facts that Dr. Wong had submitted in his opposition to the defendant's motions. The district court made two major errors as a consequence of not addressing Dr. Wong's facts. First, the court failed to appreciate that this case involves not two, but five categories of retaliation. Dr. Wong was removed as the director of a fellowship program, barred from contact with medical students, residents, or fellows, subject to having his article retracted without academic due process, subject to denigration on social media, and was subject to attempts to ostracize him in the hopes that he would resign. The district court only looked at categories one and two in its state action discussion. Second,
wasn't the court conveying that I'll use the social media commentary and the Twitter postings? By implication, the district court was suggesting that's not associated with Pitt for no need to discuss state action because of the record evidence in front of her honor, which was those accounts were not established by Pitt. There's no evidence that they had any role in it. The people who created them said so in their depositions.
That would not be correct, Your Honor. The social media harassment of my client, Dr. Wong, was initiated by Dr. Berlacher with the knowledge of Dr. Saba. They agreed, among their colleagues, to send multiple Twitter messages regarding Dr. Wong.
But how does that create state action? They would have having to act in coordination with Pitt for that purpose. UPMC is not a state actor standing alone.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
UPMC is not a state actor standing alone, and they said they didn't make those postings, or was it on an account associated with Pitt? So I'm not sure why the district court erred there.
Right, but all of the employees here, Dr. Berlacher, Dr. Saba, and the others are dual employees. They act on behalf of both Pitt and UPMC, depending on the context.
Well, the context here, that's my point, is that you're criticizing the district court for making a mistake by not addressing those social media posts, but isn't a fair inference from Her Honor's decision that because the record is we created them, Pitt had nothing to do with it, therefore we weren't acting with our Pitt hat on when we did those postings.
Well, ultimately the question is which hat were they wearing at the time?
And of course the reason
they're harassing Dr. Wong is because of an academic article he published in a medical journal, the Journal of the American Heart Association. When Dr. Wong publishes research in academic journals, he's acting in his own Pitt capacity. And
he didn't sign that he was working for Pitt in the article, but you wanted to talk about state action. Let's go back to the article separately. You wanted to stay on station. Go ahead.
Right. And so the district court failed to appreciate the multiple lines of evidence under which a jury could conclude that the retaliatory actions were jointly undertaken by both Pitt and UPMC. This evidence includes, first, the relationship agreements, which provide that Pitt reserves to itself authority and responsibility for student affairs, curriculum, publications, research, and research integrity. I'm reading from paragraph 3.4 of the affiliation agreement. That same language is found in the reorganization agreement. Second, that Dr. Gladwin only had authority over Dr. Wong in the Pitt chain of command and not in the UPMC chain of command. And since Dr. Gladwin was involved in the retaliation, it had to be state action. Third, that Dean Anantha Shaker was also involved in the retaliation.
Was the retaliatory act by Pitt through Dr. Shanker? Shanker's not a party.
That's correct. Shaker was not named as a party.
Right. He's not named as a party. So presumably you're saying that would be anything he did was on behalf of Pitt. What's the retaliatory action? Is it anything beyond seeking the retraction?
Well, the first thing, as you just mentioned, is the seeking of the retraction. Dr. Shaker was a signatory to the request for retraction, along with the 5-6 other people, most of whom were either Pitt or UPMC affiliated. Dr. Shaker was the signatory to that. He appears to have been involved in that extensively. Of course, he was a signatory.
My question was, aside from that, is there some other act?
Yes. Dr. Shaker appears to have known of and approved and encouraged all of the retaliation that was directed at Dr. Wong. We can see this in the emails that were produced in discovery and are discussed in our brief. There are a sequence of emails involving Dr. Shaker beginning on Thursday, July 30th, and then we see that again on July 31st.
Wasn't he more responding to what he's being told by the folks at UPMC? And didn't he, in fact, say that it was within their discretion to do what they did, and he had no decision-making authority over it? Isn't that right?
In fact, he did have authority under the relationship agreements because what was at issue was one of his faculty members' academic research. And under the relationship agreements, likewise under Dr. Wong's employment contracts, the responsibility for academic research is a Pitt responsibility, not a UPMC responsibility. And because it was a Pitt responsibility, Dr. Shaker is the head of that chain of command. It is his responsibility to punish or not punish, or to investigate or not investigate research misconduct. And they were making allegations of research misconduct.
Well, let's go into that then. Let's pivot into that. Several circuit courts, including ours, has talked about the debates about the bona fides, reliability, weaknesses of academic literature. Pacera, ONY in the Second Circuit, Underwager, I think it's in the Seventh Circuit. And in each of those cases, they said those sorts of debates about the bona fides of academic research should be decided by the academy and not litigated in the courts. Why does that not apply here?
Well, here...
And I'm talking only about the defamation claim. I'm not talking about the employment discrimination claims. I'm only talking about defamation.
We're talking about basically the state action issue? Why that
applies? No, defamation.
Are you going to defamation? Well,
familiar with the cases I'm speaking of. I just want to make sure you're aware of these cases that I'm addressing.
Right. Well, those cases in the defamation context are concerned with what I would call true scientific disputes or scientific literature, like the ONY case. There was a statement in that court that the court shouldn't get involved in true scientific disputes because a scientific dispute could be construed as a factual assertion. Therefore, one could claim that's defamatory and one could bring a defamation claim for it. But it's really beyond the parameters of what defamation can cover to adjudicate the truthfulness of scientific assertions. Therefore, there is a cautionary note in that case law that courts shouldn't go down that path. Here, we're looking at something quite different. We're looking at assertions of misquotes or misrepresentations in an article which was not fundamentally scientific in nature. It was a research compilation, more in the field of the social sciences. And the defendants here made express allegations of things of misquotes, misrepresentations that stripped the paper of its scientific validity.
But that was their opinion. That was their opinion also protected or non-actionable statements, correct?
Well, as district court correctly concluded, those words are allegations of fact. They're assertions of fact by the defendants. And even if they were considered to be opinions, they imply that there are non-disclosed facts supporting them.
But I thought that they imply the only facts that are captured in those opinions is the article itself and its 107 or 109 sources. That's the basis of the opinion, right?
The opinion.
The opinion offered by the declarants.
The word misquote, for example. Yes. Misquote. The basis for the opinion, assuming that's an opinion, well, we don't really know what the basis for the opinion is. All we have is their bare assertion that there is a misquote or a misstatement which strips the paper of its scientific validity.
Judge Bevis would like to ask you some questions.
Mr. Kaplan, do you have any allegation that Wiley had an extreme departure from its usual standards here, publication standards? I didn't see it.
Well, I think this would be an extreme departure.
Where do you plead that?
Well, the key allegation for actual malice for all of the defendants would be paragraph 73.
But Wiley is a publisher. I want to know, is what in paragraph 73 bears on an extreme departure for Wiley's usual publication standards?
Well, if we have alleged actual malice, that would seem to be an extreme departure from the usual publication process.
No, I'm sorry. The standard for evaluating actual malice for a publisher involves whether at least according to some case law, whether the publisher departed from his usual publishing or journalistic standards. The standard is different as to some of the people who are representing, their own opinions or something else. But Wiley is just charged with, the retraction and the retraction notice here.
Right, and in retracting his article, they made statements, or they repeated statements that had been made by defendants.
Okay, so the basis of your allegation is the statement that Wiley made in connection with the retraction. That is the basis of your claim against Wiley.
That is the defamation claim against Wiley.
But that is the basis for the actual malice allegation, that was an extreme departure from its normal publishing or journalistic standards. It didn't do anything with regard to the retraction that it would ordinarily have done.
Well, we certainly state that this is not normal for Wiley or for the other defendants, or certainly not for Wiley, to retract under these circumstances. These are extraordinary circumstances surrounding the retraction. And these defendants...
All right, let's ask about Simon. Simon is another peripheral player in here. Is there anything about Simon and Simon's involvement? Your brief almost forfeits with regard to Wiley and Simon here, but in terms of the defamation, what is it that makes it plausible that that Simon is guilty of defamation?
Well, the Simon article published by Wiley uses the phrase, that Dr. Wong misrepresented facts, and the Simon article uses the phrase that there was a misrepresentation of evidence by Dr. Wong in his article. That's the phrase that Judge Horan missed in her opinion. She couldn't find it, but it's there. Okay. And so we have those two phrases by Dr. Simon in his article, and then we refer those back to paragraph 73 of the First Amended Complaint, which to my mind is the key specification of the actual malice by Dr. Simon and by a number of the others. In paragraph 73 of the First Amended Complaint, we plead that the defendants reviewed and read plaintiff's article, and that the citations and quotations in plaintiff's article were clearly attributed, easily verified, and correct. Now here, it's either the defendants made a false accusation that there were misquotes and misrepresentations, they did it deliberately and knowingly, or they did it without checking the sources. And if they did it without checking sources, then they were acting recklessly. They were acting, in the words of, I guess it's Hart Hanke, with a, let me see, the exact phrase the case uses. One moment. In the purposeful avoidance of the truth. That's Hart Hanke's Communications versus Connaughton.
But AHA,
that's what we have here.
But the journal itself, the American Heart Association, produced two examples of how it considered the statements in the article written by the plaintiff and the statements that were in the sources relied upon, how they differed. Kind of piggybacking off of my colleague, how does that show a reckless disregard when they identified sources in the article?
Well, Your Honor, you've changed the subject in a sense, because those two examples are from the revised retraction notice published.
I didn't change the subject. I'm aware of what I'm talking about. I know the August 5th document said we're going to supplement it, and then August 6th, they did. And I think it's a fair reading of the complaint to take that as an integral part of this. But even so, they made a representation that we have examples that we're going to share with you. That was in roughly their August 5th communication. Point is, how can we take from this, at least as to the American Health and American Heart and Wiley, that they acted in that reckless disregard?
Well, again, they are repeating and agreeing with the statements made by the other defendants, or they claim they are. That's what the retraction notice does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says that the article contains many misconceptions and misquotes, and that together those inaccuracies, misstatements, and selective reading of source material strip the paper of its
Simon. Simon is not initiating this. Simon is just passing on the retraction statement. Journalists are allowed to do that. Does that reasoning not likewise suggest that Simon is not guilty of actual malice here, if Simon is just forwarding or copying the retraction notice? It's not like Simon authored this in the bit about misquotes in the first instance.
Right, well, defendant, Dr. Simon, is a different defamatory statement. The only thing he said in there that was defamatory was, misrepresents facts and misrepresentation of evidence. That Simon article was published some days later than the actual retraction notice or the revised retraction notice.
But isn't it just like cutting and pasting or copying what was said in the retraction notice?
Well, it's similar to what's in the retraction notice, but then the retraction notice itself is defamatory because they make these statements about misrepresentations.
Right, but when someone says something defamatory, the fact that a journalist reports the defamatory statement doesn't make the journalist liable for the underlying defamation. Is Simon differently situated from a journalist who repeats something? The original speaker can be held liable for defamation. My question is, does Simon get liability because of what might be defamatory from the earlier speakers that he says again?
The answer would be no, but I don't think that's what the Simon article does.
Okay, so where in the record are you looking?
I'm looking at the Simon article, appendix 170. Actually, strike that. That's the wrong page. It's page 195. So the Simon article, it says, I'll read it, in direct contradiction to its title, the retracted article by Bong misrepresented facts to argue against affirmative action, misrepresented facts. They aren't saying, hey, the retraction notice says you misrepresented facts. Simon is saying that. And if I go on and further in the next paragraph where it says, also wish to reiterate that while we welcome independent viewpoints, is with the goal of creating an open dialogue and not a misrepresentation of evidence. Again, that's Simon. He's not just repeating what's in the retraction notice, he's saying it for himself.
Even if we put, if he's saying it for himself, doesn't that further support adopting the perspectives of the other courts that have been involved in the academic debate area? I know you tried to distinguish it, well, that's hard science, this is more of a social science issue, but this is exactly what those courts were kind of looking at, is there can be fair disagreement among people who are steeped in this subject area, where they're going to debate the bona fides of a particular viewpoint based upon how they see the evidence.
Your Honor, in my view, that line of reasoning does not extend to a word such as, you know, misquotes, misinterprets, scientifically invalid, especially when accompanied by a phrase.
But there's actually, I think, one of the cases that I just identified used the word about challenging the reliability of the evidence, the validity of it. It was very close to that kind of lingo. And I'm looking for your guidance on how not to superimpose those other cases where in the academy there is a debate and there's colorful language used about one view's point versus another's. And those courts have said, that's not for litigation, that kind of debate. And I'm trying to understand why those cases shouldn't govern here.
Well, we would have to go through each of the six defamatory statements here and parse that language very carefully, because only, you know, one or two or three words in those statements are going to be representations of fact which could be actionable here. There will be other language in each of those six statements where it won't cross that line. It will be more of, hey, there's a dispute here. And then when that becomes an opinion or it becomes an issue of different scientific perspectives, we can put it that way. But there are certain words in each of these six statements which have crossed that line into an assertion of fact, which can be defamatory.
You weren't saying, though, that just any time a person accuses another person of making a misrepresentation of fact that you've got all the elements you need for a defamation claim, are you?
Well, no. There'd have to be some other elements. But here, I mean, of course, we have a professional publication, Dr. Wong, and if he makes a misrepresentation, that certainly goes to his reputation as an academic. And here we have, of course.
So if he really did make a misrepresentation, I'm going to say to you, but let's just say he said, you know what, this survey, I'm doing a survey and it had 180 people and only had 80 people. And someone wants to say, you know what, that's a misrepresentation, and they publish that. Does that mean that we're going that accusing him in another academic journal is actual malice and is serious enough that we have to send that to discovery, just if it's a dispute as to whether that was accurate?
Of course, they use misquotes as well as misrepresentation, so that misquotes is better for
stronger,
me than misrepresentation.
Stronger for you, definitely.
Right, and also if we look at, let's say, the retraction notice, you know, it adds to one because of this. They say they're going to retract the article, so they must think it's pretty serious. Also in the retraction notice, they say, hey, the editor-in-chief deeply regrets publishing the article and offers his apologies. So they must be taking whatever that is pretty seriously if they're going to apologize and retract Dr. Wong's article because of it. And so it's not just a statement of misrepresentation, nor is it just a statement of a misquote.
So misrepresentation accusation of misrepresentation plus apology is actual malice? I'm just trying to think what the holding would be.
At some point,
if you misrepresent and you apologize, accuse someone of misrepresentation, and then you apologize that you published their work with misrepresentations and misquotes, then we've got actual malice. Is that maybe you add
in the phrase, and it strips the paper of its scientific validity. So here we can add more to the hypothetical. We can keep adding these phrases and say, at what point does this become defamatory? Or at least, is it defamatory enough it can go to a jury to make a decision? And ultimately, it should be, I think, for a jury to determine if this is susceptible to a defamatory meaning. And it should be up to a jury to determine, ultimately, you know, are these things true or false? And I certainly think a court, especially at the motion to dismiss stage, should be.
So I get several of the elements. I understand, is it potentially defamatory? Is it a defamatory statement? Maybe it could be, maybe it isn't. But I guess I'm most interested in just the actual malice inference from that. I mean, even just strips it of scientific meaning. Maybe that's too extreme to say based on one or two identified misquotes. Is that the point? It was an overreaction?
Well, they don't say how many misquotes. They don't say how many misrepresentations. They just say many.
So it's almost a degree of carelessness in the sense of there might be one or two that we've seen identified. They say it's many. Cup out with an apology. Sooner or later, we're going to get to this very high standard of actual malice.
Well, I have to go back to, I don't think the record shows, you know, how many alleged, you know, misquotes or misstatements there are, because the only evidence of that is the revised retraction notice, which I still think we didn't plead. And if I look at paragraph 39 of the amended complaint, we're quoting the original retraction notice, not the amended retraction notice. And even if we were including the amended retraction notice, and those two examples aren't sound, you know, the first example is supposed to be a misquote, but there is no misquote. It's just that he didn't quote one of the sentences they wanted him to quote. And the second example from the California study isn't a misquote at all. There is no quotation in the article, so that can't be a misquote. So their examples in the revised retraction notice are quite weak. And they also say in the revised retraction notice that those are just some of the examples they're going to provide, implying, you know, that there are more of them out there. They say this is a sample. They say based on errors such as these. And if you're an academic like Dr. Wong and people are saying these things about your publication and then saying, hey, that justifies retraction of it, that's not very good for him. I mean, that's a problem. And that's just the defamation claim. Of course, we have many other claims in this case. And I see my red light is on.
Yeah, so we're going to use that time to focus our questions and we'll have you on rebuttal. I'd like to ask you on the Section 1983 claim against Pitt.
Right.
Under Monell. Right. That's my question about Monell. Monell requires a showing of a policy or custom that is violative of the Constitution. Right. You have to have Monell liability against an entity.
Right.
What is the policy or custom alleged in this complaint against Pitt?
Well, the policy or custom doesn't have to be enacted by a legislative body. It can be a single action taken by an officer or official with policymaking authority can be sufficient to satisfy.
Why are we talking about Monell? There's no municipality here. Seems like a category mistake.
No, but the university is considered a municipality under prior case law. So we do have a municipality.
Are you looking at it out of there's a case that where Temple was a defendant, and I think they used Monell. I don't know if there's a case involving
Pitt. My understanding
is
that the University of Pittsburgh is a state actor, but it's a state actor at the municipal level. So we have to prove through Monell at some point.
Why is it a state municipal level? Well, it's funded by the state. So why municipal level?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I just know that that's what the case law is, and we've been pleading and assuming that's what we had to prove. We had to prove past Monell. Now that arose on the motion to dismiss the third amended complaint, where the district court dismissed the claim against University of Pittsburgh on the third amended complaint because we hadn't pled, you know, a policymaking decision sufficient to satisfy Monell. And I don't think the court was wrong to say Monell applied. I just think the court was wrong to say we hadn't pled that in the third amended complaint. And I can go into the third amended complaint.
I'd just like to know the case law that
I'm sorry, I don't have it.
That's fine.
And University of Pittsburgh's kind of, it's gone in and out, right? It hasn't been like public, private, public again, sort of thing like that. So, I mean, I'd be interested to know, like, if the case law that we're citing for matches kind of the current status of Pitt, because it'd be weird if it was at a different incarnation of Pitt's kind of, you know, articles of incorporation or however they do.
To my knowledge, Your Honor, the University of Pittsburgh has been considered a state actor since, at least by statute, since 1966. The Pennsylvania legislature basically incorporated Pitt as a state-related entity. They changed the name of the university into the University of Pittsburgh of the Commonwealth System of Higher Education. And so as of 1966, there are statutes which basically make it a state-related institution. And as far as the case law, I mean, there are two.
But I want to hear you on the case law on that too. Like one from 84, I want to say, but you know, as I think of 1983, I think of claims against individuals acting under color of state law. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I think state claims directly against states. And you can't bring claims directly against states because that's state sovereign immunity, and that's not 1983. And so then we've got this tweener. And the tweener is municipalities. You're somewhere between individual and you're somewhere between the whole state.
Right.
And I guess I'm just – it's not obvious. If I had to bet, I'd say that – you know, University of Pittsburgh's more like the state than it is the borough of Aetna, which is a borough in Pittsburgh.
Well, the more recent Third Circuit case was, I think it's Krynicki versus University of Pittsburgh, and that's the one which reaffirms the prior decision saying it is a state-related institution, and I think you'll find in that decision somewhere saying it's considered in the municipal class, not the state class.
Okay.
I'm not positive of that. That issue has never been disputed before in this case that I recall.
I could just go back to I think you were starting to answer. You're saying when I asked about policies or customs, I believe your answer was a policymaker made a decision that's sufficient. And that policymaker would be Shankar, and the decision was to advocate for the retraction. Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, the Third Amendment complaint does get into that level of specificity about different types of retaliation. And in fact, I think in the Third Amendment complaint, we were focusing more upon his firing from the directorship position, the fellowship director, and upon the contact bar of the...
With the medical students?
Right, and those were the two things played in the Third Amendment
complaint. So how was he a policy... So is your theory of liability on Monell grounds, assuming it's applicable here, he was a policymaker?
Yes, Dr. Shankar, we allege that he is the final policymaker for this purpose. We actually allege that in the alternative. We said either Drs. Gladwin and Saba are the final policymaker, or in the alternative, Dr. Shankar was the final policymaker. He either made the decisions or he ratified them. Either way, under the case law, it would be sufficient.
I'd like to turn your attention to your Section 1981, Title 7 PHRA claim.
Right.
And the question I have is, it focuses on the doctor's article. The article makes no mention about practice by Pitt, UPMC, his colleagues. It speaks about more general practices in the field. We have a case called Curry Kramer. And in Curry Kramer, it rejected the Second Circuit's view that complaints about industry-wide practice is sufficient to be able to bring a claim under those statutes. So if he made no mention of that article and Curry Kramer is the law, would you agree that can't serve as protected activity for 1981, Title VII and PHRA purposes? That's to say it can't rely on the July 31 meeting, so put that aside. But I want to make sure that I want to understand your position on that.
No, I don't agree with you, with the way Your Honor characterized Curry Kramer. I don't think Curry Kramer rejected the idea that a statement of discrimination in the industry or in society at large can't be protected activity under Title VII. It said, I think, just the opposite. It said it can be.
No, I think what it said was we're aware of no authority that would take it that broadly, is what I think it said. It cited the Second Circuit, and right below the quotation said something along those lines.
I don't recall that language in Curry Kramer. I think they just cited that language from Sumner, which is the Second Circuit decision with approval. But they didn't say.
I don't know if they cited. I don't agree with you that they cited with approval. They cited it.
It's also dictum because that was not at issue in Curry Kramer.
I'm aware of that. Yeah. I just wanted to know counsel's view of that because we don't have any case law on that point.
I agree with Judge Bevis that it is technically dicta here. You know, it isn't controlling authority. I think it may be persuasive. Of course, the EEOC in its enforcement guidance looked at the underlying Sumner decision and said we think it's correct. And so there's authority from the EOC in addition to the case law in the Third Circuit, or the two cases in the Third Circuit.
I want to move to the next subject, and then we'll, unless my colleagues have additional questions, we'll get to your adversaries. This has to do with Title VI and the funding allegation.
Right.
Right. There's case law out there that talks about GME programs are educational, not employment. The complaint does not allege that the primary purpose of the funding was employment. It simply said there was funding, and then there was to employ the residents and the fellows, which there's other law that suggests that's all educational. So my question is, what authority do you have to say this kind of funding is sufficient for a Title VI claim? And it's...
Your Honor, I recall that the First Amendment complaint did use the word primary. I thought it did. If I could just look at my notes, I think I have perhaps a paragraph cite for that somewhere.
But even if it said primary purpose employment, that the things being funded were things that go to education, like the fellows and the residents. And so I'm not sure how your allegation demonstrates that this is for employment purposes as opposed for education purposes.
Well,
I want to make sure that there's authority for the court to give the license. Just let me finish my sentence, please. There needs to be some authority for a federal court to latch on to Title VI, and one of them is an proof of the funding or the allegation to show that the funding requirement is present. And I didn't understand how you were making that connection when funding for internships, sorry, for residents and fellows goes to education.
Well, residencies and fellowships are employment under federal law. So although it may serve a purpose of educating these trainees, it is technically in the employment category because
there's law that says that. Is there law that you can point to that says that? Because other law suggests that it's not, these are really educational experiences.
I believe we cited to a U.S. Supreme Court case, which in the tax context considered trainees, residents, and fellows to be employees.
But that's for tax purposes to make sure that.
I wasn't aware of any law saying something otherwise for Title VI purposes.
Okay.
And certainly if we look at the funding sources from Congress, they are specifically intended to pay salaries and pay benefits of these trainees.
Understood.
So it would seem that supports the factual allegation that they are, in fact, the money's going for employment.
My concern about that is just a little different. I think it matters that, you know, let's say it's a primary purpose here, but is he one of the beneficiaries of the primary purpose? Is the funding here going for supervisors of these employees as well as for the employees themselves? Let's spot that they're employed. Certainly the 2011 tax case suggests that. Still, is he supposed to be one of the beneficiaries of that, or are the law's beneficiaries really the residents who are getting paid the salaries?
Well, I assume that the beneficiaries are, in fact, the residents. That's what we meant here.
But is that enough for Title VI purposes if the money is not supposed to be funding him?
I think it would be, Your Honor, because, you know, Dr. Wong is saying that these GME programs are engaging in race discrimination in their selection of residents. Those residents are employees. If the federal funding goes to hire these people, the residents and fellows, then that would seem to be sufficient for purposes of Title VI.
You know, it's interesting, though, because there's been some effort to bring statutory standing principles, zone of interest test, whatever you want to call it, to some of these implied causes of action, Title IX, you know, thank you, Canon versus University of Chicago, kind of everything that came with that. And we're now looking at statutory standing and saying, hey, are you in the zone of interest that was designed to be protected by this statute? Do you think that a person commenting on people receiving funding as residents and fellows is within the zone of interest that the funding is for the residents and fellows? Do you follow that? Zone of interest,
sure,
that's first standing question.
My answer would be sure, Dr. Wong is within the zone of interest that should protect it because he's a GME faculty member. I mean, that's what he did until they fired him. He would teach, you know, residents and fellows. He would take them on clinical rounds. He would train them how to be cardiologists. And so he has a direct interest in that process of training. He has a direct interest in not having race discrimination in the selection of these fellows. And that's what his article goes to. If we look at the section on phase five of his history of affirmative action in medical education concerns, you know, GME hiring, residents and fellows, that's what phase five goes to. Phase five is the part of his article which is directly on employment and to a lesser extent, the phase four discussion.
Understood. Let me see, Judge Bevis, any further? Okay, we'll have you on rebuttal, thanks.
Good Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Ted Schroeder and I represent UPMC, UPP, and Drs. Berlocker, Saba, and Gladwin. Given the allocation of time among appellees, I'd like to focus my discussion on the state action in Title VII claims, although I'm certainly happy to answer any other questions you have about the claims against my clients. With respect to the Section 1983 case, this case is controlled by this court's decision in Burrell. The district court properly found that there was no state action here.
All right. Burrell, if we can sort it out into who's wearing what's hat,
right,
we should sort it out, right? Isn't it possible that, I mean, Burrell didn't have to confront a situation where two things were inextricably intertwined. So try to make it clear to me why this can be sorted out, because if it can't be, shouldn't we say, well, Burrell's applicability stops at that point and they might just be fused together if indeed some stuff starts with Dean Shekar and he's calling for the retraction and then the ball gets rolling and you wind up with people on both sides of the line who are wearing two hats doing stuff where we can't clearly say one or the other hat, or at least we can't say it at summary judgment. Maybe a jury can later say it.
Right. Well, I think the key to answering your question is what Burrell says about defining the nexus between the state and the specific challenged action. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question, I also want to talk about what what my opposing counsel said about the actions that are challenged here. And the fact is, the reason Judge Horan only addressed two actions is because that was all that was presented to her. If you look at paragraph 58 of the Fourth Amended Complaint, there are two actions attributed under the 1983 claim: the removal from the fellowship director position and the contract bar. That's it. It's undisputed that those actions were carried out on behalf of UPMC. The record shows that Dr. Saba and Dr. Berlocker made those decisions, that Dr. Gladwin was not aware of them until after the fact. And I think the if we bring it back to Burrell to answer your question, if you compare what happened in Burrell, the university employee actually reviewed, approved, and signed the termination letter, which is way more than we have here. But this court found that there was no state action because the actual authority to make the decision rested with the private entity. And that's what happened here. The authority to make the decision rested with UPMC because it controls the graduate medical education program.
If we want to play this trace of authority game, and I think it's a good metric to begin looking at, but was University of Pittsburgh in charge of like all research activities?
I believe that's what the affiliation agreement says, but the decision that really, I think, just emphasizes the fact that this wasn't a decision about research. This was a decision about who gets to supervise the graduate medical education program. That's a UPMC program. Whatever was going on with Dr. Rong's research was certainly something that the university could have supervised if it wanted to, but UPMC in the graduate medical education program is not confined by that and any limitation.
So when anyone's looking at his research, right, the first moment that anybody up the chain of command from him looks at his research, they're doing that in their Pitt capacity, right? They aren't doing that in their UPMC capacity. That's Pitt, right?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by look at. I guess that's the question.
Just here's an article.
Right.
By Dr. Wong.
Right.
We have some concerns with it. Please take a look at it. Let's just say that. If they're looking at his research, are they and Pitt had control over research. And we have to pick ads, and we'll assume that we have to pick. I'm not sure we have to, but let's say we have to pick. Shouldn't we pick Pitt?
Well, no, because the decision here, again, wasn't about his research. It was about his supervision of the fellowship program.
Based on his research, right?
Based on his views. I mean.
Manifested from his research that they can look at in their Pitt capacity.
Well, could have, but that's not what they're doing. I mean, the record.
So maybe that's a jury question then. Maybe that's a if the question is they have control over research, but they didn't look at this for research purposes, but purely for UPMC purposes, Isn't that really close to a genuine dispute? I can see that one both ways. Couldn't a jury see that one both ways?
Again, I don't think so. I mean, if Pitt had taken an action, you know, as a result of his research, that would be one thing.
But that's an easy case. That's the easy case. I'm totally with you. I think
that just sort of, you know, that just begs the question of what decision was being made. And again, the decision was about the GME program and his role in the GME program, and Pitt doesn't have anything to do with that.
What about the traction statement, though? You said that if it has something to do with the research, it would be a Pitt act. Here we have the retraction statement. Does that provide a basis for any relief for the plaintiff?
Well, I guess I'd start by, again, saying what you said in response to Judge Bevis's question, which is that the retraction statement was not pled or argued as a basis for the Section 1983 claim. Also, again, the only individual defendants on the 1983 claim are Saba, Berlocker, and Gladwin. And again, the specific conduct that they are charged with committing or alleged to have committed in violation of 1983 relates to their role in the GME program. That's the UPMC program.
We were talking about research and articles, and you probably heard me ask your adversary some questions about those cases that talk about the academy and the debate in the academy, and shouldn't it be left to the academy to work it out rather than bringing it to a courtroom? What is your position about that as it relates to the defamation claim?
Well, certainly that is our position. That is, we did argue that position to the district court. We raised it again in our brief. You certainly, I think, you know, cases like the ONY case, Second Circuit, that you mentioned, I believe, stand for that proposition, and the statements related to, you know, misquotes or false interpretations or things of that nature are really statements of academic debate, which aren't grounds for a defamation claim. Although certainly that claim could also be affirmed as to Drs. Saba and Berlocker on the grounds which the district court ruled, which was a lack of actual malice.
Judge Bevis and I both asked your adversary about Kramer Curry and its statements about how specific must the criticism be or the oppositional activity be to the current employer. Could the statements in the article by the doctor about the ACGME accreditation process, which is something that Pitt needs to presumably have to fulfill. Does UPMC have to fulfill that too?
Well, Graduate Medical Education Program does, yes.
So do both of those entities have to meet the accreditation requirements of ACGME?
Okay. Yes.
So could one infer that his comments about the from his point of view, the troubling requirements of the accreditor is a complaint about any entity, including his employer, who had to subscribe to them?
Sure. I think the short answer is no. I don't think so. And if you go back to the language of Kramer, which not only we rely upon, but which is cited on page 62 of appellant's opening brief, the opposition must identify the employer and the practice. Again, it doesn't identify this employer. It doesn't identify a specific practice of this employer that's alleged to violate the law. So on those grounds, we would argue that the article is not protected activity.
Okay. And since you represent UPMC, I had the Title VI question.
Yes.
We're all obviously trying to get our arms around what's required to be pled for Title VI, whether federal funding that's directed GMEs qualifies as employment funding, and whether or not the plaintiff is in the so-called zone of interest. So what is your positions concerning the applicability of Title VI here?
Yeah, I think we focus more on the primary purpose language in the statute, because in fairness, the complaint does allege that funding is used for employment, but it doesn't provide any detail or factual detail around that, and it certainly doesn't allege any facts that would support a conclusion that the primary purpose of that funding is for employment, particularly when, as noted, there are lots of other purposes for it, including for education and training.
Okay, let me see if my colleagues have any further questions. Anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, Hopefully, Counsel for Pitt, who I'll let you enter your appearance, will be able to tell us, are you a municipality? Are you closer to the state? Are you in the tween, as my friend says? So why don't you enter your appearance, Counsel?
May it please the court, Brian Boynton for the University of Pittsburgh. The statute says that the university is a state-related entity. That raises questions about what that means. There might be arguments, theoretically, that the university is an instrumentality of the state, therefore not a person under Section 1983. There's case law rejecting that argument, not raised the argument here. Our opposing counsel and plaintiff has never contended that Monell doesn't apply. The alternative would be to treat the university like a person, then you would be outside of Monell, but the university is not like a person. So if anything, I would say the university is more like a municipality than a human being walking and talking. So it's never been disputed that Monell is the governing standard here. Under that standard, they would have had to plead a policy by the university. The amended complaint doesn't do that. They try to argue instead that there was action taken by a policymaker. Under the case law, it has to have been a final, a person with final unreviewable policymaking authority. That's the McGreevy case that they cite. There are no allegations that Dr. Saba and Berlocker, who took the relevant adverse employment actions, had that kind of authority. Now, that may raise the question, what about the retraction?
Well, and Dean Shankar.
Shankar counts, right? He's a dean.
So we have not disputed that Dean Shankar has final authority for the university.
Okay. And
that's correct.
He's the one who gets the ball rolling on the retraction.
Dean Shankar signs the retraction, so we haven't disputed that he has a role in the retraction. He did not take any of the other actions that are the
basis. Why isn't the retraction enough?
For the claims. The retraction is not enough for any of the claims for a number of reasons. First, it wasn't pled as a basis for the 1981 Title VI retaliation claims. It wasn't pled as a basis for the Section 1983 First Amendment claim. It actually wasn't even pled as a basis for the Title VII or the PHRA claims. However, at summary judgment, plaintiff did argue that that was one of the retaliatory actions for those two retaliation claims. We think there are at least two reasons why those claims fail. First, a retaliatory action has to be materially adverse, has to be so significant that it would cause a reasonable person to be dissuaded from taking protected activity. Here, simply calling for a retraction on the basis of identified errors in an article is not so materially adverse that it would dissuade a reasonable person. This is just the give and take of academia. Second, this is itself a speech action, calling for a journal to retract an article on the basis of identified errors. And the plaintiff have conceded in their reply brief that in order for a retaliation claim to lie against speech activity, you have to have speech that takes the form of a threat, coercion, or intimidation. And there's nothing about asking for a retraction of a journal article on the basis of identified errors that would rise to that level. I see my red light has come on.
Okay, I'm gonna give my colleague here a second to take a gander at what he's looking for.
No, nothing.
You're good? Okay, I wanted to ask you, because you're in the academic world, these other circuit courts that have relied on this perspective that the academy should debate things among themselves, why should that apply or not apply in this scenario?
So the defamation claims against the university fail for a number of reasons. First, they're purely derivative, and so they could only lie against the university if the university were vicariously liable because the relevant actors were acting within the scope of their university employment. And here, for Berlocker and Saba and Simon, that was not the case. I do agree, however, that statements about the validity of an article, particularly where you're making an academic argument and you're pointing out the basis for your argument, it's very hard to see how a defamation claim can arise from that kind of a statement.
Okay, counsel, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Mike Berry, and I represent Wiley Periodicals. I'm going to talk just about the defamation issue. And I'd like to start with the point that you raised first off, Judge Schwartz. This is an academic dispute that centers on scholarship and scientific validity. And as Your Honors said in Passera, Debates dealing with data and methodology should be settled in scholarly discourse, not through litigation. The issue here, as Mr. Renner explained, is that Dr. Wong's piece was labeled as scientifically invalid. That is a subjective interpretation that under this court's decision in Becerra, under ONY, and that line of cases is protected under the First Amendment. And as this court—
you really think that's subjective?
Whether something's scientifically valid?
Yeah.
Absolutely, in the same way that it was with respect to the analgesics in the Becerra case, a decision about what is appropriate, what should be published, what is retractable, what is in the best interest or the public interest, as was said in this editorial, is something that's at core First Amendment. Ultimately, the academy, the debate about what is appropriate scholarship, whether it's in the context of something that's a hard science or social science, the idea is to have the ultimate pursuit of truth. The only way that that could be discussed and debated is having academic debates back and forth. It's absolutely an opinion. With respect to what Mr. Renner argued in this particular retraction, he said that the word misquote, misconceptions, misreadings of the sources, that that is a verifiable as fact. Well, that's wrong in two ways. First, with respect to the term misquote itself, in our papers we point to Supreme Court case law explaining that a misquote can be something taken out of context.
From five justices in 1958 in the context, it's not really on point.
Exactly, but it is an explanation of what something is that is a misquote. Okay. He says that's not what a misquote is. We can't even agree on how is it objectively verifiable. It's just like the term liar in Hill versus Cosby, or it's like the allegation in the Kuwait versus Golfling case that somebody had violated the law, or that something's not thoroughly researched, like in the Vino case. Those things may look on their face like they're verifiable, but they're considered by the court's opinion, and these are opinions based on disclosed facts. And here, the retraction notice disclosed those facts. Here, they pointed to Dr.'s article, which has footnotes and then endnotes, and that's exactly why scholarly articles have those things, so that the select audience, the scholars, can look at those things and verify for themselves. Is this correct? Is it not? When Wiley retracts the statement and says that there's misquotes, there's misconceptions, that there's misreadings, scholars can go and look at that. And then, as Judge Schwartz pointed out, the retraction said that it would be updated, and it was, and it further explained it. There's nothing to suggest that Wiley or AHA was privy to additional information outside of Dr. Wong's article. These are disclosed facts, and it's a classic opinion. There are other indicators within the retraction notice itself that show that this is an opinion. It talks about what's in the public interest. It says that Dr. Wong doesn't agree. It says that there will be further rebuttals published. Rebuttals, agreement, public interest. These are classic notions of what is an opinion, and it's protected speech under the First Amendment. If your honors would like, I'd be happy to address the actual malice questions that Judge Bevis had raised earlier, although I think that this case could be firmly decided on the opinion.
Why don't you go to those questions?
With respect to actual malice, the question is, what is the publisher's actual state of mind? Do they know that what they're publishing is false, or do they actually entertain doubts about its truth? And with respect to this publication, the pleading itself shows that there is no evidence of actual malice. There's the allegation that's being made in Dr. Wong's complaint was that UPMC and the doctors at UPMC, his colleagues, his supervisors, wrote to Wiley and wrote to AHA and said that there were misquotes, misrepresentations of evidence. And Wiley then relied on it. Reliance on credible sources, as is clear in this Third Circuit precedent, is the antithesis of actual malice. In the Dickey case, the reliance on a congressman who is aware of the plaintiff and the charges against him, no actual malice. In the Marcone case, relying on a credible journalist, no actual malice. In response, Mr. Renner, I believe when he stood up here, answered the question, said, well, they looked at it the first time in the peer review process. And I believe, Judge Bevis, you asked about extreme departures from normal journalistic practices. Well, in McCafferty and Hart Hanks, the court said that's not enough. In Marcone, the court said in the Third Circuit, the failure in the verification process, in the editorial verification process, that's not evidence of actual malice. These things don't go to whether Wiley knew that what it was publishing was false or whether it seriously doubted the truth of what it published. To the contrary, by publishing the updated retraction statement with those examples, we know that there was not. I'm happy to answer any questions y'all might have.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your counsel.
We ask you to affirm. Thank you.
May it please the court, Stephen Ettinger on behalf of the American Heart Association, and it's a real privilege to be here before you today. From the AHA's perspective, this is a purely academic dispute. Judge Schwartz, I'll preempt your question. As this court and other circuit courts have emphasized, academic disputes about the validity of scholarly articles are poor candidates for defamation litigation. Most notably, the academic context makes a number of problems for assessing that fact-opinion paradigm, and disagreements about academic conclusions are generally not actionable. Instead, the trial of ideas plays out in the pages of peer-reviewed journals, and the scientific public sits as the jury, and that's what should happen here. Dr. Wang authored an article, that article was criticized, and the audience of cardiologists can assess that dispute. The trial court's decision should be affirmed because the underlying dispute is just an exchange of opinions supported by disclosed facts.
Okay, let me see if my colleagues have any questions. Any questions?
Okay. we're at this point in the afternoon. You've sat through much of it, so I could be totally off base in my memory of the record. But didn't your client use the phrase deliberate? Didn't your client say, am I thinking of the right one?
Yes, there are a number of...
Didn't your client say deliberate misinformation?
Deliberate misinformation.
Yeah, and doesn't that's just a lot different than what we'd think of as scholarly debate, right?
I would say it's a little more harsh in tone,
yeah.
But I don't think that changes the analysis. First, I would say that it was not directed to Dr. Wang specifically. I understand the inference can be made. However, it was more about improving the peer review process. But even if it could refer to Dr. Wang, it's still not defamatory. As written in McCaffrey versus Newsweek, everyone is free to speculate about someone's motivations based on disclosed facts about the person's behavior. Similarly, in the recent Jankowicz opinion, this court considered speculation and conjecture about a plaintiff's motives and stated that these statements were still opinion statements that could not be readily verifiable.
It kind of feels like what doesn't belong. I mean, if the whole system is we want academic debate to get to the truth of it, truth, and then you sit there and say this guy's being deliberately just a bad actor. It feels like it's kind of more ad hominem than in search of the truth.
I could certainly see that, but I think that it's still part of that opinion paradigm that, you know, it's not a verifiable statement.
Do you think that if a deposition of Dr. Wang showed up and said, did you do this, you know, do you believe this to be misinformation that you did deliberately? I mean, did you deliberately misinform people? I mean, couldn't he just say yes or no and have a jury decide, is he credible when he says yes or no on that?
I imagine that he would say no in that deposition.
Yeah, that's probably right.
But I would also say that Dr. Wang's article is essentially an advocacy piece. It's not really a scientific article, even though it's in a scientific journal, but everything about the article was deliberate. But I just go back to...
But you make some factual assertions about there being many misquotations, misrepresentations, etc. There appear to be only two alleged ones, neither of which is, strictly speaking, a misquotation. Your client went beyond simply retracting the article.
Right. I would say that a statement is necessary as part of industry standards, that retraction shouldn't be made silently. There has
okay.
to be an explanation.
You could have said, questions have been raised about this. In abundance of caution, we retract and express no further opinion on it, versus going out there and making these assertions that not just his opinion is wrong or hateful or even racist, but that it's just factually, like the it's on a foundation of Swiss cheese. That's in essence what you said. That's a factual substrate, and it's not an opinion based on fully disclosed facts here.
On the many aspect of it, I think we've focused a lot on the misquotations aspect and less about misconceptions.
Well, you would agree even two does not count as many.
I would agree. That's
all right. So that's factually wrong.
That there were many misquotations, yes. But I think that there can still be many misconceptions.
Okay, so even if there are misconceptions, they're not disclosed facts. So this isn't protected as an opinion based on fully disclosed facts.
Well, I think that they disclosed the role of UPMC in notifying the journal of its investigation.
All right, it's fine. I think this might be a different case if you had quoted and said, according to authors, employer, quote, you know, we've been notified that, quote, there appear to be many misquotes, whatever. But you went more than journalist role of forwarding this, saying out of abundance of caution, we're retracting it based on the statement. You adopted and embraced this statement as your own.
Sure. But I would say that, again, that the statement that was adopted is more in the opinion realm, that it's not readily identifiable, and that's just part of a larger academic dispute.
Okay.
Anything further, Judge Phipps?
No.
Okay, counsel, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I represent Dr. Mark Simon.
I'd like to hear what you have to say. Your friend on the other side very powerfully argued that Mr. Simon, as the lead author of an article, did more than simply forward what others had said. He embraced and adopted these statements as his own, didn't he?
Well, I think what Mr. Simon did, or what Dr. Simon did, Judge Bibas, is not only did he say there were misrepresentations made in that article, but then he cited to additional evidence that would suggest why those were misrepresentations.
Okay, is an opinion based on those facts, and the question is whether that disclosure of facts takes the sting out. But he's not simply a journalist reporting on that fact. He's offering this opinion based on some facts. We can argue about whether they're disclosed or not. We can argue about whether they're accurate or not.
Well, in his response, what Dr. Simon says is ample evidence exists to establish the benefit of diversity on healthcare outcomes, and then he cites scholarly articles.
Okay.
So from his point of view, not only has he identified why this is a misrepresentation, but he cited to the sources for those.
I don't know, you know, like, misrepresentation strikes me. You say that, you know, you say that, this wagon is red, and then someone else says, no, the wagon's not red. And that's like a misrepresentation. It's not what color the wagon should be. And as I read these two sentences here, he says there was a lot of misrepresentations, and scholarship shows that the other outcome is true. But it doesn't strike me that just proving that there's another outcome means that you can say that someone did misrepresentations and not have that kind of little more ownership associated with that.
Well, I do think, Judge Phipps, that what he actually says is that they're misrepresented facts to argue against affirmative action.
In the field of cardiology.
Dr. Wong misrepresented facts to argue against affirmative action in the field of cardiology. And then he cites the alternative facts.
So my issue is this. It's a weird phraseology, right? Because facts are true or false, typically. We live in a world of First Amendment defamation where it's fact opinion. Your client says he misrepresented facts. And now we're supposed to say that's an opinion? Because we're already in a dichotomy of fact or opinion. And so when you call out facts and then you don't identify those facts, you just say, hey, here's the alternative scholarship. I would totally, it would be nice if you said misrepresented facts, this quote meant this quote meant that. Doesn't do that. Just says there's alternatives, then has three footnotes, like 4 through 6, that say this is the alternative version. But I'm a little troubled by the misrepresentation of facts, because I think we live in this dichotomy of fact opinion. And when you start saying, no, this isn't an opinion, I'm telling you these are facts. I mean, it may not be where his mind was necessarily, but on a fact-opinion dichotomy, it moves me at least to think it's more like fact. Is that wrong?
If we continue on through his article, one of the other things that he does is he says, okay, these are the benefits of diversity in healthcare. Here they are. And then he delineates them.
Are you also saying that your article, the article, because of the way you've described it, is he says why and cites to sources for his difference of different view, demonstrates no reckless disregard and therefore no no actual malice?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I agree with that, and I also point to at page 41 of the appellant's brief, the opening brief, they identify the paragraphs of the claim that reference actual malice. And in particular, they reference paragraphs 38 and 39 on the First Amendment complaint. Those paragraphs don't mention Dr. Simon. So from the point of view of allegations of actual malice, it seems to me the district court got that right.
And when I'm using the phrase actual malice, I'm not using it in the colloquial way, I'm using it in the defamation way, which is reckless disregard for the truth. Is that what you're trying to convey to us?
Yes, I am.
Understood. Okay.
Yes, I am.
And so it would sure help if, to prove that there wasn't reckless disregard when you're saying that someone misrepresented facts, you would show what the fact was and why it was misrepresented. That would go a long way to saying, you know what, this wasn't reckless. I wasn't just throwing around, you know, big incendiary words. I actually meant it. And so it's a little weird to me because I would have expected there to be fact one that was misrepresented, fact two that was misrepresented, fact three, and then maybe another paragraph that would say, and by the way, this is where the arc of the academic scholarship goes.
Well,
your turn.
I do sort of think he gets there, because what he says is the notion that diversity does indeed improve care and outcomes. So he's explaining what it is about the facts that he's relying on that differ from Dr. Wong's perspective, and then he
Dr. Wong's conclusion. I get it. The academics have the articles dispute the conclusion. They really, really dispute the conclusion. But you're saying that his method is bogus.
Yeah. Well,
that's what's interesting to me.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we ever actually say his method is bogus. I think what we are saying is he's misrepresented the evidence that's contained at least in the articles that we've cited. And so frankly, to one last point that I would make, I think it does go to the point about the back and forth in an academic context. And while I might agree with you, Judge Phipps, that we might have done it better or differently, at the end of the day, it seems to me we've probably, from my point of view, diffused any allegation of actual malice.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have enough of a break?
Your Honors, I just have a few points in response. I think my friends, Mr. Schroeder and Mr. Boynton, talked about what was alleged in the Fourth Amendment complaint, asserting essentially that we hadn't raised the other three grounds for retaliation.
As to the 1983 and they say 1981 claims. That's where they're saying that you didn't raise those other grounds. Now, Judge Horan appears to have treated all these grounds as relevant to 1981 and Title VII and PHRA, so you might be fine there. But it does appear that both the complaint and Judge Horan's opinion were on 1983 were really focused on terminating the moving as a director and barring contact. So I think we have to focus on those two as the adverse actions for state action 1983 purposes.
Well, certainly the Fourth Amendment complaint was intended to include all five retaliation grounds.
Intended to, but I don't see the words on the page.
Well, I would refer to three paragraphs that I know were added to the Fourth Amendment
complaint. Okay, why don't you show me the actual words in the Fourth Amendment
complaint? All right, well, I'm looking at page 391 of the appendix. We're starting with paragraph 49. That's a whole paragraph talking about the denigration of plaintiff on the social media and the Twitter account.
If you could just give everybody a chance, because people are flipping through their materials, that's okay.
391, paragraph 49. There's some tweets here.
Correct. So the paragraph 49 on page 391 talks about their campaign integration through their tweets. And their tweets aren't just on the at Pitt cardiology.
I get account. That, but this is general background before we get to account. When we get to the specific count, paragraph 58 specifies two particular actions as section 1983 in the First Amendment. It specifies removing him from a position as director of the fellowship program and precluding him from having contact with medical students. The specific seems to take precedence over the general here. Now, it's only as to the 1983 claim that we have an enumeration of two and only two of these. But you're trying to bring in some of the general background here into the first claim for relief, presumably because it tries to incorporate all the previous allegations. But there's a specific focus in paragraph 58, and the retraction and the other items aren't part of that focus.
Well, of course, paragraph 56 does, as Your Honor just said, incorporates all the previous allegations, which includes paragraph 49 on the campaign of denigration. And on the next page, we've got paragraph 51, which specifically looks at his academic due process rights being violated by the request for retraction. That's paragraph 51. And then in paragraph 52, we have the campaign of ostracization. Okay. So all three of those paragraphs are here.
So
in my
view, this seems to be like an area where we accord some deference to what the district judge was fairly on notice of. When I look at Judge Horan's opinion, as to 1983, she understands there to be two actions she's supposed to be focused on, and her opinion is just about those two. Whereas with the other actions, Title VII, 1981, PHRA, she looks at the five that you listed in your opening argument. Given that you were the master of the complaint and this was your fourth chance pleading it, it seems reasonable to take her at her word and approach. It's not like she overlooked something that very clearly and obviously pleaded that as to 1983.
Well, in response to that, Judge Bibas, I would say that during the summary judgment hearing, you know, in the papers we filed on summary judgment, mm-hmm. and in the oral argument that we our side made summary judgment, we pointed to these three grounds for retaliation. We tried to be very clear about it in our papers submitted to Judge Horan and the oral argument presented to Judge Horan that they were part of our 1983 claim. I agree that she didn't catch that or she didn't address it. But I mean, to whatever extent the Fourth Amendment complaint could have been clear. We were very clear in the summary judgment context in terms of how we briefed it, in terms of the additional material facts we put in on that question, and in terms of how it was argued early in front of Judge Horan at the district court level. And in fact, we haven't gotten to this, but we had, in our opposition to the other parties' motions for summary judgment, we put in 20 pages of additional material facts, which we wanted the court to look at, and that included these three grounds for retaliation. And I didn't find a single reference to our facts in her opinion below.
So you talked about, at summary judgment, making certain arguments, but this 1983 claim didn't survive a motion to dismiss as it relates to some of the parties, correct?
Right, but the parties where it did survive were the three individual defendants, so we'd be Gladwin, Saba, and Burbank.
For what cause of action, though? They didn't survive. The 1983 claim, as it relates to Gladwin, Saba, and Berlacher, didn't survive the motion to dismiss. So if that's true, then anything you added at the summary judgment would not have been edifying on the 1983 claim.
I think that's mistaken, Your Honor. The 1983 claim did survive as to Gladwin, Saba, and Berlacher, and that was what was addressed in summary judgment. What didn't survive was the UPMC and UPP claims that had been dismissed earlier, and the Pitt claim had dismissed earlier. So those three corporate parties were gone by the time we got to summary judgment. On summary judgment, we still have the three individuals.
I stand corrected. I understand.
Right.
I understand.
My red light is on. I
just want to see if my colleagues have any further. Judge Bibas, anything further?
No.
No, counsel, we are all set here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What we're going to ask counsel to do, and again, thank you for your patience as you waited for all the arguments in front of you, and I know there are a lot of advocates today. Thank you for your excellent work. We would like a copy of the transcript of today's oral argument, and given the number of you, we're going to ask you to figure out a fair way to divide the expense for that. So we'll take the matter under advisement with our thanks for your hard work in this matter.